Who are we? The third talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by Wes Hurd on October the 10th, 2000, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
It's actually not who are we, it's who are we. Emphasis in the right place. We're doing a series here at the Study Center on Tuesday nights called Biblical Christianity 101. And the idea behind it is to lay out in simple, straightforward terms what we here among the teaching staff at McKinsey Study Center feel are sort of the essentials of the gospel and the essentials of understanding the biblical worldview. Of, in particular, what does it mean to be human, and who is God, who is the Creator, and how do we, what is our relationship to Him, and how do we figure all that out? So, as Nancy mentioned, we started off the first week with where do we get started, or how do we start, and that was about the Bible, how we approach the Bible. And then last week, Jack gave his usual easygoing, roll and tumble talk on who is God. And this week it's my assignment to talk about who are we. And what I'd like to do is start off with a thought picture, this sort of a quiz. Let's assume, for the sake of my illustration here, that an intelligent visitor from another planet arrives on the scene, and that this intelligent visitor has the assignment from his or her world. We don't know what the gender is, or if it's gendered. What would you say? He. That he has the assignment of figuring out who we are. That is, what are these creatures that are known as human beings on this planet Earth? So let's start with that question, and let me put the question to you. Where would this creature look first, do you think? Or where would this creature tend to look for answers to the question, who are you, or what are you? Where would the creature go to find this information? Okay, he'd interview people, talk to people, maybe even leaders. Okay, where would be another source of information about who and what we are?
Movies, art.
Movies.
Survivor.
Movies. TV, films. What else? Families. Okay, talking to groups of these units called families.
Internet.
What if they were looking for how to figure out where we came from? Where would they go for that? Okay, probably into history books, maybe into libraries, looking at historical documents, huh?
Biologists would say something.
Okay, maybe they'd interview some scientists, some biologists, and they definitely get some interesting answers from there. What would these creatures who came to visit us and find out who we were, what would they find out? What would be some of the things they would do you imagine they would say first about us?
Top of the food chain.
Top of the food chain, okay. What else? What would they say about us as they looked at TV, they looked at films, they read books, they looked at history, and they were sort of doing this detective story to put it all together? What would some of the top things that they would conclude be? What would they say?
Self-oriented.
Self-oriented, meaning?
Self-absorbed.
Self-absorbed, okay. Concerned about our own selves. Okay. Other things?
We die.
We die. We're born, we die. Worship strange things, okay? Maybe they would even stumble over the idea or question the idea of worshiping something, but maybe not. Maybe they would have their own system. What else might they conclude about us, human beings? About sort of the what would they describe as the core nature? One thing is already said, that we're selfish. What would be another one?
Mm-hmm. This may count with selfishness, but greed.
Greed, okay. We're greedy. We like to take care of ourselves and more and more and more of ourselves. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody mentioned, but fear.
Fear. We're fearful. Interesting. What do you think we're afraid of? What do you think they would say we're afraid of?
The unknown.
The unknown, okay.
Them.
Afraid of them, okay, depending on what they look like. So, do you think the composite picture that they would put together, what do you think they would conclude? They're gonna email their results, their conclusions back to Planet X. What kind of picture are they presenting of the human being, of who we are, what we are?
Basically directionless as a whole, coexisting, but just kind of day-to-day.
Okay. Would they conclude anything about... Let me just stop there because we could go on for a long time with this. But my point in trying to get at some of these questions that I've asked in this hypothetical visitation is that the enterprise of figuring out who we are or what we are, what we are as human beings, deciding what it means to be human, is actually a very strange task in some ways today. It's strange because we live at a time when asking the question, just asking the question, is kind of a strange phenomenon when you look at human history. What do I mean by that? Well, I think we live at a strange and a difficult time in human history because it's only been about 200 years and maybe even the last 100, 150 years that our culture in the West, to the degree that that culture of the West has sort of encompassed the entire globe, it's only been in that recent history that the whole question of origins and who we are and what we are has come up in the way that it has come up. By the way, let me make a note here about what I think the difference is between saying, "Who are you?" and asking the question, "What are you?" What do you think the difference is? If I say, "Who are you?" compared to, "What are you?"
Identity.
Which one?
Are you asking me what is my identity?
No, yeah, which word though? Who or what? Which?
Well, who are you is your identity.
Okay.
What are you is more biological or abstract.
Okay, your nature. Okay, yeah, I think so. What is so significant about the question of who are you? What is so significant about that?
Your origins. Your origins.
Okay. Yeah, it's like if somebody walks up to you and says, ask the question, hypothetical question, what are you? You could say, well, I'm a human being. I'm a Homo sapiens. Maybe you could give your gender and then you'd start talking about your ethnicity and a lot of other kinds of things just to describe your nature, who you are. But if they said, who are you, what would you say? Huh?
Let me think about
it. Who are you? What would you, what's your just off the top response? Who are you?
I am becoming.
Okay. Somebody else? What's a really streetwise response, just a kind of ordinary common sense response?
Your name.
Your name. Mm-hmm. And what does your name... What is the significance of your name? What does it do for you?
Individuality.
Okay, it definitely gets at individuality. Does it not give you an identity? Does it not tell someone not just what you are or your nature, but it tells someone who you are, that is your significance, maybe even your genealogy, or maybe even a certain sense of where you came from, your origin. And why is that so significant? I think it's significant because it has to do with asking about what do you mean? Do you have a purpose? Are you here for a reason? Do you have meaning? Are you significant? So the question that I'm going to address tonight for a little while, the question of who are we, really does come together with the question of what are we also. But they are distinguishable questions. Now, I said a few minutes ago that we live at a strange time, and what I mean by that is it's only been in the last 150 years or so, since even 200 years, since this event, this historical, intellectual revolution occurred called the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was a time where a group of leading cultural thinkers and philosophers arrived at the conclusion that the historic, traditional understanding of the Bible and the Bible's explanation of the origin of the world, the origin of the cosmos, of the universe, and the origin of man, that was a myth, that was no longer scientifically credible. It was a time in which a bunch of work was being done under certain kinds of historical, cultural theories, and those theories promoted the idea that the Bible was a collection of myths, a collection of nice historical stories, parables, narratives, even poetry about the Jewish nation and the Judeo-Christian story of man, but that in terms of its scientific credibility, its actual truthfulness, that it couldn't hold up. Now, not everyone believed that, but a great many of the most influential thinkers in our history, in our culture, believed that. And as a result, that idea began to spread, began to saturate down through our educational institutions, universities, down through to where we are 200 years later. And if you were to walk onto the university campus, any major university campus or most colleges in this country, you would find an attitude that assumes that the Bible is myth and that the account of the history and origins of the cosmos and of man is in fact not true. It's simply mythological in character. It's a nice set of stories if you want to believe it because it makes you comfortable and gives you secure feelings, fine, but don't try to assert it as the truth. It's interesting because this radical shift basically was about, well, picture a person, picture a man or a woman walking out on a starry night onto a hillside in a brilliantly clear evening. And you've been there. You've been camping. You've been out in the country. You've been out in the desert. You've been in this place where you look up at the sky after dark, and maybe even you got up because you couldn't sleep, and you got out of your tent, and you looked up, and you saw this blanket of stars. And you see this incredible, awesome display above you. And you look around, if it's a natural setting, you look around and you're compelled to think about, what is this all about? Look at the design. Look at the beauty. Look at the magnificence of this. And your conclusion, very naturally, I would argue, is to say that this just didn't happen by accident. That this came about because someone, something created this. It has the marks and the features and the magnificence of something that came into existence with beauty, magnificence, purpose, and meaning. And even if I don't know exactly what that is, I assume that it's there and that I want to know about that. Well, see, that was the attitude of man throughout history until just about 200 years ago. Now those same human beings walk out into this vast arena, look up at the sky, and start thinking about it in different terms. There are terms that go something like this. If everything that exists, basically they start with this assumption, that everything that exists is physical or material, and that everything that exists exists as a result of a combination of chance plus time plus matter. Chance plus time plus matter equals what exists. In other words, what came into existence, what exists, is here by accident. By a chance configuration of elements, of physical elements that came together in a certain way at a certain point in the cosmos, and voila. Now, if you start stretching this out into certain kinds of conclusions, we can draw at least four very significant conclusions about the question, who are we? Now, what I'm putting up here is the view that dominates the world today. It's the world that dominates the Western world. It dominates the scientific Western mind. First of all, since chance and time and matter are really all that ever existed, we can say that there really is no particular design for what exists. Because why? There's no designer. So there can't really be a design. What exists and what appears to be a design is really a product of chance and time and matter. Secondly, we can conclude that there is no intrinsic purpose or meaning to what exists. Why? Why isn't there meaning or purpose? There's no design. There's no designer, there's no purposer, and so we begin to extend that out and come to realize that even though we might want for there to be meaning, we might want for there to be purpose, in fact, it's not possible that it could exist. Because if we start and we stay consistent with what we understand to be the origin of everything, there is no purpose inherent in that beginning. Thirdly, we could say there are no absolutes. Or we could say there's no absolute truth in the sense that, and this is a common kind of extension of logic from this, how could there be absolutes when everything is in flux and everything began by chance? So, and the last thing, and this is where we come down to the question of who we are, is that this is an impersonal beginning. Impersonal. And therefore, this is an impersonal existence. And man or human beings, even though we like to attribute to ourselves a sense of being persons, in fact, that's really not possible. Why? Why is it not possible?
Because our existence is simply a coincidence. There's no reason you can, or others around you, if your existence is because of the chance.
Okay.
There's no
personal, if we decide to create that language or create that as a cultural artifact that we simply use, sure, I can call anything personal. I can personalize lots of things. But there's no... The point I'm making is that if we take this worldview of an impersonal universe and we stack it up against the logic of its implications, we can't really arrive at the fact that human beings are anything different or anything more significant than any other thing, whether it be simply a single atom or an animal, or a tree, or a rock, or anything else. Roger?
If you don't mind entertaining questions, would people who hold this worldview, do they recognize local occasions of design personhood, I mean, maybe on the overall scale, no, but they acknowledge localized
Certainly we talk about, we see design, and so there was to be local, what you're calling local occasions, sure, I think so. But ultimately, we have to say that the design, in quotes, is ultimately not based on any designer. It itself is based on and comes out of chance. So it might have some kind of appearance of design, but even at that point, the universe, the way it's going, what science is explained to us is that the universe came into existence by accident. This order exists here temporarily, and as millions and millions and millions of years spin out, eventually the universe is slated to die or to compress and expand again, in which case something in the midst of this basically impersonal history really can only assign itself in some temporary sense or self-defined sense to be personal in that sense. Now, I'm taking a little bit more time than I really wanted to do on this because I want to make a point. I think we live at a time when the logic of the assumptions and beliefs of the modern technological world that we live in, grounded as it is in the Enlightenment ideas of a couple of hundred years ago, that everything is not based on the existence of God, but rather is based on a series of chance events and matter and time, that leaves no room, or let's put it this way, it raises huge problems for the question of who we are. Let me read you an example of this. Anybody remember, this is a little bit dated now, the book called The Ascent of Man by Jacob Bernowski, came out, in the 70s. It's basically a kind of historical scientific theory about the growth of the human being in history and civilization. Let me read you a quote by Jacob Bernowski, and I'll read it fairly slowly so you can follow the logic here. "We have to accept the subtle but closely woven evidence that man is not different in kind from other forms of life, that living matter is not different in kind from dead matter, and therefore that man is an assembly of atoms that obeys natural laws of the same kind that a star does. My fundamental assumption is that man is a part of nature. Man has to be put among the animals. An unbroken line runs from the stone to the cactus and on to the camel. There is no supernatural leap in it. No special act of creation, no spark of life was needed to turn dead matter into living things." Now, this is sort of a great model, a great kind of quintessential example of the modern Enlightenment, secularist, humanist view of our origins and the grounds out of which we have to decide who we are as human beings. However, times, they are a-changing. Now we're moving, in the last 10 to 15 to 20 years or so, we're sliding into a period which people are beginning to call the post-modern period or post-enlightenment period. What in the world could that mean? Well, we can't talk about that a lot tonight. We don't have time. That's another talk. But suffice it to say that in the postmodern period that we're moving into, the definitions, the scientific, enlightenment, evolutionary-based definitions of who we are now being questioned. They're being questioned in a different way, because there is no one single modernist enlightenment model for how we look at ourselves. Now, in the postmodern period, we're beginning to decide that, you know, if they're Aboriginal tribes or South American ethnic peoples who have stories about who we are and what we are, Who is to say that they're wrong and the modernist Enlightenment perspective is right? Postmodernism is questioning the whole basis of any truth at all, and therefore all truths are possible. Quote, truths. So, there is no truth with a capital T, which at least the Enlightenment people clung to, the idea that there could be truth that could be found. Now we're moving into a postmodern time in which truth only exists with a small t, but we can bring all kinds of small truths into the picture, whether they be ancient truths, modern truths, medieval truths, whatever they might be, and entertain them as possibilities. In other words, the modernist model of explaining who and what we are has somehow failed. And all I want to say at this point is that it's an interesting time to live because there's, I think, at least a new opening, a crack in the door in a lot of people's thinking about how do we define what it means to be human. And there's a great search. There's a great search going on for how we decide who we are as human beings. And the great search that's on is grounded in this great problem that was generated a couple of hundred years ago. A problem at a time when traditional understandings of, like, the biblical, Judeo-biblical, and Christian view of who we are and what we are, or even the Hindu view, or, you know, all kinds of different religious views, were basically written off as primitive myths. But all of that has sort of been thrown up in the air again, and now we're re-examining everything. Now, what I've just said is a context for going on to the question of trying to address what does the Bible say about who we are? And that's where I want to go now. Let's look at, we can't survey the whole Bible on this question. As a matter of fact, I'm only going to spend my time, the rest of our time tonight, talking about who and what we are, not about what our problem is, which is a great deal about what we are now. Because the Bible has a picture of what we were when we were created, what we are now, and what some creatures will be in their destiny in the future. There are different things going on, and I'm only going to talk a little bit about the originating picture of who we are, what we are. So I'm going to look at Genesis, just at a couple of very obvious verses, and then we'll turn to a psalm, and then I'll turn to a very cryptic New Testament passage. The first passage I'm going to look at is in Genesis 1. It's in the creation passage where God is creating the heavens and the earth. And I'm going to begin, I think I'll begin with verse 24 just to give a little lead in to the verses I want to focus on. In verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So here we have a picture where the biblical author is saying, God created man. And he created man a particular kind of way that distinguishes him from the rest of creation. What is that way? What did he do with man that he didn't do with all the other creatures, according to these verses? Sorry? Yes?
He created it with his own image.
Image,
yeah,
exactly.
He gave it his likeness.
Right, likeness, right. What does this mean? What does it mean to be made in God's image? What could that possibly mean? I think this is extremely important, extremely amazing, and well worth understanding as best we can possibly figure that out. First of all, we notice that none of the other animals bear the image of God. It's very clear in this text that God stops at a certain point, having created all the other creatures, and says, we want to make this being, we're going to make this creature, I'm going to make this creature after my own image. Again, whatever that means. Now, no other creature has this, but that's not to say that the other creatures aren't really amazing. I mean, there's a certain sense in which how many people here have watched Crocodile Hunter? Come on. Put him up there. Okay. Crocodile Hunter. He's great. He's my favorite show. No, I'm okay. I had to bring that up. Have you ever noticed how completely bonkers this guy goes when he's looking at animals? I mean, kind of creepy animals too. But he's looking at this mammoth crocodile. And he's saying, "Wow, Crocky, ain't she a beaut?" And he goes and he examines, he turns it over. I mean, this huge animal. And he just goes on and on and on about the magnificence of this animal. He does the same things with this snake. He holds a snake up that's, 6 feet long, and that if it bites him, he's dead. and he's going on about the beauty of this creature. And he goes, catalog animal after animal. He finds these insects, and he finds all these. You know what? I think he's right. I think that he's not just being, he's not just using hyperbole. I think he's really noticing the beauty and the magnificence of creation. And that there are these amazing animals, which in many ways have powers far greater than ours. I mean, think of the power of an elephant. The power, the sheer power of a whale, the power of an eagle to fly by itself. I mean, we can create machines to do these things. We can get machines to catapult us through the sky, and machines to go under the water and the bubbles and stay alive. But those are alien to us. They aren't a part of our nature. So these animals, this creation that God has made, and these magnificent creatures are more beautiful in some ways than we are, more powerful than we are. They can do things that we can't do. They're amazing. But the one thing they don't have that we, according to the scriptures, have is this design, this something planted in us called the image of God. It's like somehow God, the fingerprints that God put on us didn't stop short like the other creatures. He ended up implanting in us something about us that's like him. Now that's a bit of a mystery. We don't really know exactly what that means. We know some things that we can extrapolate from looking at the Bible and just looking at our own experience, looking at history. We can come to some kinds of conclusions about what that means. But this idea of being made in the image of God, of bearing what I'm going to call, we call it image-ness. That is unique to us. So, what about this image-ness? Is there some sense in which our physical bodies bear the image of God?
Let's see, if God is spirit, so the part of us that is the image of God would probably be our spirit, because our bodies go back to the earth.
I think you're correct. I think you're largely right, and that's the direction I'm going here. Raising the question about our bodies, I'm just being kind of really explicit and real simple about this. There's something about us, the way we are, that expresses the image of God. And I think the answer to that is kind of unanswerable in one sense. We don't have any biblical data that would tell us that. But let me just speculate and say that, is there some sense in which possibly man as male and female, Mensch in German, is there something about our physicality that may express something about God? I think the answer to that question is yes. Let me put it this way. This is speculation. It's just my idea, so I could be full of wool here. But every time I look at a piece, listen to a piece of music, or look at a piece of art, or handle something that's been made, I always come away with the impression that something of the maker is displayed in the physical substance of what is there, or the sound, if it's music. When we make art, no matter what it is, for example, there's something of you that always shows up in that piece. Even if it's a photograph. You say, well, I'm just out there shooting pictures. But if you're trying to capture something that's beautiful and significant and meaningful to you, I would argue that the very selection process that you choose, that you go through to select what you select, tells me something about you. May not be much, maybe just barely suggestive. But I would argue that that's what making art often is all about. Or not all about, but that's one of the significant elements of art, is that it tells you something about the maker. And I think in a similar kind of way, perhaps, even our physical bodies, even the way male and female work together, that being human means male and female, that God, in that design, has told us, has put some kind of fingerprint there that identifies something about him. That's all I can say at this point. But clearly, I think I agree with what this gentleman over here says, that the real image of God is not about our outer, about our physical nature. It's about our inner nature. It's about our inner self. It's about our mind. It's about our heart. It's about our soul. It's about our passion. It's about that soulish, inner, invisible you. The part of you, when you die, it's that part of you that is not going to die. It's going to go on. And there's various ways to describe that, but I think that's the location, the profound location and nature of the image of God lies there. Let me just rattle off a few thoughts about what the image of God might mean. And I'm drawing this from various sources, commentaries on the Bible, various passages in the Scripture. These are sort of extrapolations from various places. There are people who like to think about the image, who think that we should think about the image of God as being really a short, describable thing, not an elaborate thing, but something very that's pretty cryptic in a sense, very simple. What they say is that the image of God means that we are spiritual beings, like God is spiritual. God is spirit. We are spirit. Image means that we can have true knowledge. That God has created the cosmos, the universe, and us in such a way that our knowing processes link up with and correspond to what is out there to be known. And so the human creature, man, bearing the image of God, can know in ways that are significantly different than any other creature. And that we can even know analogously or like God knows. It means that, thirdly and lastly, that we are moral creatures. That we're spiritual, that we can know, and that we are moral creatures. That is, we are distinguished from the rest of creation, from the rest of the animal world, by the fact that we are able to identify what is good and what is evil. Whereas those kinds of distinctions don't exist for animals. So we're moral in nature the way God is moral. In fact, that was one of the concerns that the author of Genesis gives us in chapter 3, where after man has collided with God, there's been a rupture that I'm not going to talk about tonight. After that happens, God is concerned about man. It says in verse 22, "Then God said, 'Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever.'" So man, his concern was that now that man had gone through this rupture, the result of which was that he became a self-defining creature like God, that he decided what was true knowledge on his own autonomous terms rather than in dependency on God, that the worst thing that could happen to him would be able to eat of this tree that would give him eternal life, and he would go on forever thinking that was true, that he was in fact the center of the universe. That would be a horrible thing. A little longer, wider view of the idea of the image of God, expanding on some of this a little bit, that human beings bearing the image of God have the power of thinking, we have the power of thought, we can have true knowledge, I've already mentioned that, which means that perhaps, maybe we could break that down a little bit, it means that we can abstract things in our thinking, the ability to look at something, analyze it, break it down, be critical of it. We can be abstract about it. We can manipulate that our knowledge. And we can extrapolate from the knowledge. If A and B are true, then what follows from that? C. That we have those kinds of thinking powers. That kind of knowledge, in fact, is tied in with, ultimately, with our moral nature. That God will hold us responsible for what we know, because we can know, we can abstract, we can extrapolate our knowledge, and God will hold us accountable and judge us because we have that ability to see what is right and what is good, and to extrapolate into all the spheres of our life the implications of that. And when we don't do that, that evil fact, God will hold us accountable for. We can also transcend ourselves. How many people had a conversation with yourself today? See, you were transcending yourself. You were stepping outside yourself and you're saying, "Self, let's talk." We can transcend ourselves and look back at ourselves and be conscious of ourselves. Self-consciousness is an attribute that I think that might be attributable to the idea of being like God in some way. We can communicate in very elaborate, extensive ways with our knowledge. I'm not saying other animals can't communicate. I'm not saying other animals can't think. I'm not saying animals don't have feelings. But the powers of each one of those in human beings are vastly larger and expanded and more profound. And we are self-determining creatures. That is, we are free from the universe, the determinations of the universe and the cosmos and the forces of this world. We are free in ways that animals, the rest of creation, is not. As Jack raised the question last week and made the distinction between being free from the universe and the cosmos, not free from him, ultimately, in his transcendent creating authoring power, but free from everything around us and therefore accountable for the kind of beings that we are. That we can make choices that are true choices, that have consequences, and that those are very significant. Let's look at Psalm 8 for a moment. Okay, Psalm 8. Here is a psalm that is about, I think it's written by David, King David. on one of those evenings, perhaps, when he did what we talked about earlier, he walked out into a starry night and he looked up. And here's the psalm that he wrote as he was completely overwhelmed by what he saw. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth, who hast displayed thy splendor above the heavens. From the mouth of infants and nursing babes thou hast established strength because of thine adversaries, to make the enemy and the revengeful cease. And here he goes. When I consider thy heavens and the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little lower than God, and dost crown him with glory and majesty, and thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hands, and thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and all the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, and the fish of the sea, and whatever passes through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. I would argue that this is a poem by a man who truly sees the awesomeness and the power and something of the glory of God in the cosmos, in the universe, isn't that? That little bit of the universe that he's able to see is so overwhelming that he is taken aback by it. He's floored by it. And in the context of being completely overwhelmed by it, he says, wait a minute. Look at this. Who are we, these puny little creatures? Who are we that you give any thought to us, that you even notice us? And yet, somehow, God, the unthinkable, the most amazing thing, you have made us to be creatures who are just a little lower than you. Now, I think that's hyperbole in one sense, but in another sense, it's very, very significant. Because what he's implying here is that human beings, creatures like us, you and I, have been created by God to bear and manifest a glory, a magnificence, an awesomeness, a beauty that no other creature has the privilege of so doing. It's not about, in a sense, it's not about ruling over the fish and the dogs and the sheep and that kind of thing here. Certainly we have those powers. But I think he's getting at this amazing fact. He's pondering and his mind is overwhelmed with the fact that God has made man and woman to be creatures who reflect in some utterly magnificent way a glory that God himself shares. That he shares something about who and what he is with us in some strange, mysterious way. And I think that's what the poet David is trying to get at, that thou dost crown him with glory and majesty. So when we ask the question, who are we? Instead of tracing ourselves back to chance and matter, we trace ourselves back to the God who is there. The magnificent, awesome God who is there. And in some amazing, almost unthinkable way, we discover as we look through the Bible and see the story that unfolds in the Bible about who we are, we find our origins there. I am, you are, this creature made by the very hands of God to, in some way or other, in some mysterious, magnificent, amazing way, reflect and stand for God in some particular way in all of creation that no other creature does. So, our identity, who we are, is located in the God who is there. And what we are is also bound in who and what he is and who and what he has made us. Now, I'm just going to leak this and I'm going to stop for questions and answers. Not that I have any answers. I've said everything. Next week, David Crabtree is going to come and talk about what's our problem. If this is all true, if I'm in some way truthfully, accurately portraying the magnificence of our existence and who we are, and how amazing we are, and how beautiful we are, and how glorious we can be, and in a very real way, we are, in spite of our failure and brokenness. In spite of the fact that we now are, because of the fall, because we have fallen into sin, which David will talk about next week, we are in some way, the magnificence and the beauty and the amazing nature of what we are has been distorted. It has been stunted. But in spite of that, our identity, our significance, and everything about us is bound up in our Creator. And bearing the imageness of God is incredibly significant, because bound up in the destiny, what comes out of being made in the image of God is a destiny for those who desire it, for those who long for that destiny, to be true human beings. Do you remember either watching a movie or reading a book about Indian Native American culture, or maybe other culture, where there are certain things that are being talked about in a narrative, and one of the Native Americans, Indians, says, I think it was the Sioux Indians, who actually called themselves human beings. Anybody remember that? Yeah, it was in that movie. That they had in their culture, in the way they looked at the world, there were human beings were supposed to live in a certain way, and a true human being lived in a certain way. And if you did evil, distorted things, you weren't a human being. Imageness and bearing that imageness has to do with being a true human being. Now, we do have a problem. But even in the midst of our problem, there's a great promise and there's these great facts about us. And I'll close with this kind of a downer quote, but it's a great quote, so I'll use it. This is from one of my an artist that I really like a lot. In fact, I used this quote in my thesis for grad school last year that I rambled through. It's by an artist called by the name of Paul Klee. He's a modernist. Paul Klee said this: "The ideological capacity of man, that is the ability of man to think ideas, to create and compound and possess ideas, the ideological capacity of man to penetrate earthly and supernatural spaces at random, wherever he chooses. We have this great ability to expansively think and penetrate and discover and know. In contrast to his physical prostration is the origin of human tragedy. This combat between power and prostration implies the whole discord of human existence. Half winged and half imprisoned, that is man. And here is the revelation, that where there is a beginning, there can never be infinity." I think that this is a lament, a very, very poignant, kind of sad lament, a grieving, about what this human being, this artist, observes about the human situation. That on the one hand, we are great, magnificent, amazing creatures. On the other hand, we are imprisoned. And as we look at history and even ourselves, we see a great capacity for destruction and self-destruction that we carry out all the time. And he says that brings great, that's the origin of tragedy. Great magnificence and failure. And then he goes on to say, where there is a beginning, there can never be infinity. And I think that's just it's a kind of one way of saying, I see the problem, I see my finiteness, I see my beginningness, that there, I'm not infinite, I'm not eternal. But I long for transcendence. I long to be able to get beyond my own finiteness, my own limitedness, my own... And a great deal of these kinds of quotes and problems come from men and women of the modern and postmodern world who have lost the great heritage that we have in the picture of who we are and what we are from the Bible. Okay, I'm going to close there and leave a few minutes here for comments, remarks, observations. Maybe you have some things that you could share with us that I wasn't able to say.
I was going to ask about your modernist timeline and to extract any biblical reason for existence and just using the modernist timeline and take society as a whole. Let's imagine that our culture views life in that way and humans' values and purpose in that way. About, I think it was a week or two ago, there was an infant conceived for the express purpose of using it to help a bone marrow transplant of its sibling. And I never really thought about it until tonight about the modernist, would you assume, would grab something like that and hold it up as, now there is a purpose for something like this to happen. Everybody else may be random, but this child is a product of design. Maybe it's designed by humans. Its odds of existence were selected and chosen by humans, but even at that, it's got an intrinsic value most humans don't.
Yeah, I think that would be an example of the kind of a kind of truncated, limited thinking that we're forced into when we deny that human beings ultimately have, all of us have our origin in God. We can come up with a temporary, short rationale and explanation and definition of design, but it's only a short, and it only works within that worldview. And also that worldview excuses the tragedy that is, that we are usurping from God what only God should have, namely to providentially originate every human life, so that we're taking into our own hands a kind of Babel-like prerogative.
So the modernists would see that as a huge triumph of what we can do with our material world.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a thought on what the imageness means. I was thinking that maybe a way to even expand it so it doesn't just focus on what inwardly makes us in God's image might involve how we can go from imagination to create things, or be co-creators with God. And I think that's where the whole area of culture comes in. And I was thinking how an anthropologist might address the question, how are we different from animals? And one of the things that comes up is that we're, as human beings, we can imagine symbols and we can express symbols outwardly that have layers of meaning.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to hear you talk a little more about how we are like God in the way we can create from our imaginations or from our thoughts, and then how that relates to culture and social grouping, because some of those things distinguish us from other animals.
Well, I think you've already said it pretty well. I don't know that I can say a whole lot more. I didn't actually say anything about that, the idea of creativity. The whole idea that we can, I think it was sort of subsumed under the idea that we can abstract our knowledge, but I think the fact that we have imaginations is tied to this idea that we can transcend ourselves. that we can imagine realities. I was in the bookstore today, and I wandered through the fantasy novel or fantasy fiction section, just row after row after row of fantasy fiction. And, you know, that's just one category, one genre of our ability to create realities, to create stories, to create narratives, to create things. And I was kind of stunned at the fact that the vastness of that kind of what you're talking about, the imagination, our ability to create. And of course, the sort of classic, you know, theological perspective, biblical perspective on that in general is just that we can create analogically. That is, we can create like God. We don't create from nothing like God did and does, but we create from the stuff that God gives us. We can do, we can make plastic things, whether it be sounds or movement or spaces or images or languages. And we do indeed use all these things in a very amazing way to create what you were talking to about just a minute ago about culture. We create environments for ourselves, and those in a fallen and broken world, that's a very important thing to be able to understand, how those things act on us, how the things that we create, culture, how it can act back with great force on our lives. Yeah.
Your quote of Bernowski, somewhat ties in with your timeline, your chance, time, and matter, in that seems to me that he said, if you can't, where you can imagine a beginning, there is no infinity. And that as I look at the timeline, people are...
Oh, that was from Paul Clay.
Oh, was that Clay? Mm-hmm. Okay. That rather summarizes a lot, because we are cut off after a certain time, so we can't comprehend really what it's like to be a God. And at the same time, we can't, because of this thought picture, we can't imagine anything before our own beginning, because, you know, the Bible says that we were conceived and we were known before we were created. So that we have to have the ability, in order to, I don't know if that makes any sense, but it, well, I believe it does make sense, that the beginning is with God, and the end is with God, but man tries to establish himself as a God in the interim, and it's just very frustrating. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds redundant, but it seems like...
Well, I think David's going to spend quite a bit of time talking about that in some detail next week, that the frustration, the problem that we have, that is really, has a very, very significant, important, critical knowledge, vital knowledge about us and who we are and what we are today, has to do with what he's going to talk about next week, even though I was kind of concentrating on our origin and what we are as creatures. Okay, you know what? I'm going to let you go. Thank you for coming. See you next week.